The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today I'm going to be reading to you from two different issues of Time Magazine. The first one is the most recent that we have at our disposal here in the studios, and that's August 2/August 9, 2021. These will all be articles that have not been read previously, but I'm also going to be drawing from an even older edition, July 5/July 12, 2021. Also, one of the staff members here at the studio has just pulled from the internet, that is printed from an internet search, an article from Time's Internet Stories, and that is entitled Biden's Botched Withdrawal. That will be the lead article for today because it is hot off the press, or as nearly so as we can manage here at the office and studios of North Carolina Reading Service. Again, this is from Time Magazine, online, on the internet, dated August 16. That is today, the day that I'm recording this. In early July, President Joe Biden informed the American people of the coming drawdown of U.S. forces from Afghanistan after a 20-year occupation. The evacuation would be secure and orderly, he said, with little chance of a Taliban takeover. The likelihood there's going to be the Taliban overrunning everything and owning the whole country is highly unlikely, he said. Little more than a month later, Biden has been proven wrong on all counts. The Taliban took over Afghanistan Sunday, entering the capital city of Kabul with no resistance after a two-week-long blitz in which multiple provincial capitals fell into the insurgents' hands. President Ashraf Ghani, that's G-H-A-N-I, fled the country Sunday, abandoning his fortress-like palace to the black-turbaned militants who roamed freely in his offices by day's end. U.S. diplomats, meanwhile, rushed to destroy sensitive documents and equipment at the sprawling U.S. embassy. The building's American flag was lowered and flown aboard a helicopter to the Kabul airport, where U.S. personnel gathered for safety. Like a long-anticipated death, Americans knew this day would come, but the collapse was so sudden and complete, it was stunning when it finally did. It is a reality difficult to fathom. After nearly two decades of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, more than 2,300 of its troops dead, more than 20,000 wounded, hundreds of thousands of Afghans maimed or killed, and $2 trillion spent. On the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks this September, a Taliban flag will fly over Afghanistan. Biden's miscalculation could alter his presidency and weaken U.S. standing overseas. He supported the invasion two decades ago, but had long since concluded it was time to leave, and he got elected to the presidency on a platform of pulling troops out. So how could the White House have been caught so flat-footed? Biden administration officials routinely argued Afghanistan's 300,000-plus troops and police, which the U.S. has spent at least $84 billion to train and equip, vastly outnumbered the estimated 75,000 Taliban fighters. They pointed to Afghanistan's air force of attack planes and helicopters, which were also paid for by the U.S., as well as the firepower and heavy weaponry. In the end, though, not one piece of this multi-billion dollar arsenal, which now all belongs to the Taliban, could replace the willingness to fight or the instinct for survival, as Afghan troops saw fellow soldiers who surrendered to the militants were allowed to live, and those who fought were often brutally executed. U.S. intelligence assessments initially estimated Afghan security forces could stave off Taliban offensives against major population centers like Kabul for a year or possibly more. Just this month, the timetable was significantly downgraded to within 30 days or less, according to two current U.S. officials. Instead, Afghan defenses lasted 10 days as the troops repeatedly acquiesced to the insurgents, allowing them to walk through Kabul's city gates untouched. The U.S. is now working through the logistical nightmare of evacuating thousands of American and Afghan personnel along with their families. The airport represents the sole means of escape, since the Taliban has methodically encircled the capital and cut off critical supply routes in and out of the city. Taliban spokesmen have repeated anyone who wants to leave can, unmolested, but few Afghans want to test that public promise with their lives, as sporadic gunfire and looting has broken out across Kabul overnight. Biden ordered thousands of U.S. forces to the Kabul airport to help evacuate Americans and Afghans who collaborated closely with the U.S. for decades. Congressional lawmakers were told Sunday during a 45-minute conference call with Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and General Mark Milley, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that the first of 6,000 U.S. troops began to arrive at the Kabul airport over the weekend. Lawmakers were told there were tens of thousands of Afghans who could qualify for special immigrant visas, according to a person familiar with the call. General Kenneth McKenzie, commander of U.S. military operations in the Middle East, is now overseeing the evolving situation from a base in the region. A U.S. military official tells Time they're working to safely evacuate Americans and as many Afghans as possible who might be at risk of Taliban reprisals. Meanwhile, Afghan officials outside the country are working to get out their colleagues who might face retribution if they were left behind. One in the Gulf is working to bring a plane from Qatar to bring senior Afghan government staffers and some of their families. But by late Sunday, commercial flights at the city airport were suspended amid intermittent gunfire, and only military aircraft were allowed to operate. A lot of dignitaries are stuck in the airport like sitting ducks, the official says. There's no immigration officer to stamp passports. It's total chaos. The official shared with Time a cell phone video he got from a friend trying to get out at the airport, of panicked Afghans rushing to board an empty aircraft, not waiting for permission, standing in the aisles, refusing to give up their seats to ticketed passengers. With reports of gunshots and militants on the civilian side of the airport, the senior Afghan officials are torn. We don't know if it's a wise decision to sit in the airport, but they fear for their lives if they go back to the city, the official says. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said U.S. forces have now assumed responsibilities for air traffic control at the airport. Commercial traffic continues, though it's experienced some sporadic stoppages and delay, he said in a statement. Several hundred civilians, including personnel and private U.S. citizens, have been evacuated so far. We continue to build capacity to expedite processing for at-risk Afghan civilians. Other senior Afghan officials have opted to stay. an aide of Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, chairman of the country's High Council for National Reconciliation, tells Time he will be flying to Doha, Qatar, as part of a team that includes former Afghan President Hamid Karzai to negotiate the shape of the incoming government. U.S. and Taliban officials did not respond to requests for comment. Sworn enemies of the Taliban, like Afghan Vice President Amrullah Saleh and Ahmad Massoud, son of assassinated Northern Alliance leader Ahmad Shah Massoud, have remained in the country, returning to their home province of the Panjshir, multiple current and Afghan officials say. Saleh, that's S-A-L-E-H, messaged Time that he's in one of his mountain bases. Ghani, G-H-A-N-I, for his part, posted a statement on Facebook that detailed his reasons for fleeing. If I had stayed, countless countrymen would have been martyred and Kabul City would have been ruined, in which case a disaster would have been brought upon this city of 5 million, he said. Meanwhile, the situation's perilous for everyday Afghans who do not have the means or connections to leave. U.S. officials who worked in Afghanistan are getting panicked messages from Afghan translators and other staff who were not granted U.S. visas in time or could not get to the airport where U.S. officials are trying to rush through thousands of applications before sending them on to Qatar for further security checks and processing. I'm still out here and waiting for the U.S. to save me, one Afghan messaged a long-serving U.S. official. How do you respond to messages like this? The official asks. I've been getting them all day. The United States' longest war may be drawing to an end, but the bloodshed is far from over. The world's focus will be on the safety of Afghan allies and Afghan women who were systematically victimized under the Taliban. Biden, however, figured this into his calculation long ago. Do I bear responsibility? Zero responsibility, he told CBS in February 2020 of the possibility women would lose rights under a new Taliban rule. The responsibility I have is to protect America's national self-interest and not put our women and men in harm's way to try to solve every single problem in the world by use of force. And this article has reporting by Alana Abramson, Washington. From one of the older editions of Time magazine, I will read this The View article. It deals with Haiti, and Haiti is again in the news these days because of natural disasters, the earthquake, and now a subsequent tropical storm or two. It is under the heading, The View, World, What Haiti Needs Most, by Dimitri Elias Leger. When Jovenel Moïse, a deeply unpopular president of Haiti, was assassinated July 7 by a squad of gunmen posing as DEA agents, the news stunned and horrified the world. As Haiti has descended into chaos with calls for U.S. intervention, the world should consider the leadership vacuum this murder creates to be a vital opportunity. Most Haitians shrugged off the news and braced themselves for the worst, while praying the violence that's plagued their lives the past few years will not be exponentially increased by the violence of losing their freedom to foreign forces. The drumbeat of news of brutal killings and kidnappings of neighbors and friends, priests and commoners, children and cops, has become routine in Haiti since 2018, when an unforeseen spike in gas prices triggered protests against the Moïse government. That's M-O-I-S-E. Over the past 3 years, gang-related violence has reached a fever pitch of terrorism and opportunistic crimes. By this summer, many parents of means began sending their kids to live with relatives in New York City, Miami, Paris, and Montreal, and enrolling them in schools in those cities for the coming academic year as they sought business and career opportunities on new shores. The last people Haiti could afford to lose were following the international community and bailing out on Haiti. Both in 2018 and 2019, I myself was evacuated from Haiti by UN security after violent protests broke out and made getting any missionary work done impossible. The UN eventually gave up on Haiti after nearly 15 years, probably a decade after Haitians had given up on the UN. The hope for peace and prosperity it represented was snuffed out. Moïse's death is the culmination of years of lawlessness, frustration, and hopelessness in Haiti. Call it peak failed state. But President Biden can chart a new, richer direction for U.S.-Haiti relations if he plays this moment constructively. Calls for Biden to send in U.S. troops to broker peace between the government and the gangsters and pave the way for elections are misguided and far too short-sighted. Washington's alternated between punishing Haitian leaders with cruel embargoes and humiliating Haitians with military takeovers since the country was founded almost 220 years ago. Washington should not try using UN peacekeepers to serve as front men and a pacifying force in Haiti either. Haiti's criminals, both white and blue collar, spent the duration of the most recent UN peacekeeping mission in Haiti, gorging on profits from the economic bubble created by the UN, and sadly enough, sending most of those profits abroad. It is time for Washington and other would-be friends of Haiti to try a new approach to helping Haiti develop. Focus on the economy, guys. Every future Haitian president will be a dead man or woman walking after a year, like Moïse and his predecessors, if the economy does not bring tangible improvements to Haitian lives. The success of Haiti's economy will enhance and protect its democracy and the careers of its politicians and policymakers. After all, the most common knock against Haiti is it's the poorest country in the very wealthy Western Hemisphere. But being poor in a rich neighborhood is not a sin, it's a launching pad. Having rich neighbors like the U.S., Canada, and the Bahamas, and a successful sibling like the Dominican Republic, the country Haiti shares the island of Hispaniola with, is a boon to Haiti. Unlike Afghanistan, number 169, and the African nations in the bottom 40 of the UN's Human Development Index, which ranks countries annually after measuring their citizens' average life expectancies, years of schooling, and gross national income, among other factors, Haiti, number 170 out of 189 countries, is a mere two-hour flight to the 17th most developed nation in the world, the U.S., a good swim from the 58th, the Bahamas, and can move goods by truck to the 88th, the Dominican Republic. Make no mistake, the news of the president's assassination stuns and terrifies Haitians. If Biden wants to intervene constructively in the lives of the 11 million in Haiti, whose empty stomachs cannot be filled by ballots, he must offer better trade relations with the U.S. and prepare an economic stimulus plan to develop Haiti in partnership with the Dominican Republic, Haiti's business community, and sustainable development engineers and farmers. Haiti has good assets to pump cash into, perfect beaches, weather all year round for tourism, thriving arts, entertainment, and literature that annually produce some of the best novelists, musicians, and filmmakers in the Francophone world and the U.S., agriculture, gold mining, and a multilingual workforce. What Haiti's always lacked are good neighbors and fair trading partners other than Cuba, Brazil, and Venezuela. With a terrible stroke of his pen, President Clinton destroyed Haiti's rice-exporting industry with surprise tariffs. Subsequently, Haiti has had to import rice from Arkansas, among other places. Biden can change that pattern with trade policies that aim to get the Haitian economy back on its feet sustainably and get millions of Haitians working. Haitians have been protesting for the same kind of freedom since 2018. I'd argue Haitians have been asking Washington to similarly respect and honor our passion for freedom and economic sovereignty since 1804, when Haiti forcefully rejected slavery and Napoleon's rule, despite generating half of France's GDP with its productivity. Back then, the U.S. responded to Haitian calls for dignity and commonwealth building with embargoes or military dominance. Biden can become the first U.S. president to truly support Haiti's clarion calls for freedom. Dimitri Elias Leger wrote this article, and he's the author of the novel God Loves Haiti, and a former advisor to UN missions in Africa and Haiti. Again, within the brief portfolio of an older edition of Time, the brief opener headlined Religion, Will U.S. Bishops Break Bread with Joe Biden? By Brian Bennett. There's a small inset photo here in this one-page article of a group of people. Let me see. 1, 2, 3, including President Biden. First Lady Biden is there, too. And they're all dressed like they're going to church because they're standing outside the door to a church. And the person facing President Biden is cloaked in green vestments. So it must be a clergyman during the long green season of Trinity. More people are crowded at the doorway waiting to exit, but I presume they're waiting in line so that they don't interfere with President Biden's security staff. A politicized rift in the American Catholic Church widened in June as U.S. bishops voted to draft instructions to the faithful on who should receive communion. That's with a capital C, with an eye toward dissuading high-profile Catholics who support abortion policies and gay rights like Joe Biden from presenting themselves for the ritual. According to a church official, many bishops had been concerned about the confusion such an apparent conflict could otherwise cause among Catholics. Biden regularly attends Mass and takes communion at St. Joseph on the Brandywine near his home in Wilmington, Delaware, and at Holy Trinity in Georgetown, 2 miles from the White House. He has long turned to his faith for solace, close friends say, in particular during times of trial or personal tragedy. But how the president practices is personal, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said June 21 in response to a question from Time. That's how many Americans see their faith as well, not through a political prism. In many ways, Biden represents the culmination of decades of increased Catholic representation in American politics. 6 out of 9 current Supreme Court justices are Catholic, as are the Speaker of the House, multiple cabinet secretaries, and senior officials. Catholic voters cast 1/5 of the votes in the 2020 election, about half of which were for Biden. But Biden's presidency also comes as the church is struggling internally over how to navigate the role of the spiritual in a polarized political sphere. Within days of his winning the White House, 10 of the nation's most powerful bishops launched a working group on how to handle a Biden presidency, meeting over Zoom to discuss a response to his policies that conflict with Catholic teaching and how to minister to his soul. Now they've gone further. During an assembly on June 17, U.S. bishops voted to draft a teaching document on the beauty and power of the Eucharist. Jose H. Gomez of Los Angeles, president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, said in a statement, when the bishops gather for another assembly in November, the document will be discussed and its release will be voted on. The bishops want to clarify communion's purpose for priests and laypeople and call for consistency when worshipers present themselves for the rite, that's R-I-T-E, said Bishop Kevin Rhodes of Fort Wayne, South Bend, Indiana, who's leading the writing of the document, in an interview with Our Sunday Visitor, a Roman Catholic publication. The vote is another example of the conservative American bishops moving in a more political direction, says Massimo Fagioli, a theology professor at Villanova University and author of Joe Biden and Catholicism in the United States. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has become beholden to the political agenda of the Republican Party, Fagioli says. But the fact that half of American Catholic voters backed Biden shows that many are seemingly open to policies that embrace gay rights and access to abortion, even if they go against church doctrine or their own personal beliefs. Biden also campaigned on several issues the church embraces, such as aiding refugees, advancing racial justice, ending the death penalty, and addressing climate change. And some church observers are concerned that the bishop's hardline approach to Biden is a symptom of an attitude toward the faith that could further alienate American Catholics at a time when congregations are shrinking. The move also cuts against a welcoming tone set by Pope Francis when he became pontiff 8 years ago, allowing more perspectives to be aired within the church. Francis, who clashed with former President Donald Trump over racism and immigration, has repeatedly shown his openness to Biden in closely choreographed moves, seen as signaling a desire for dialogue and engagement. In May, a papal advisor, Cardinal Luis Ladaria, sent the U.S. bishops a letter warning them that moving forward with a teaching document on communion could sow discord, and that effort should be made to preserve unity in the church. This is not the first clash between Biden's faith and politics. In 2019, while he was campaigning in South Carolina, a Catholic priest released a statement saying he denied Biden communion because of his stance on abortion, but asked July 18 at the White House whether he thought the bishop's decision could lead to his being denied the sacrament. Biden said, "It's a private matter, and I don't think that's going to happen." Here's a short item under the heading Vaccines. The World Might Need a Booster Shot by Alice Park. As the U.S. focuses on vaccinating 70% of American adults with at least one dose of a COVID-19 shot, scientists say we may need another booster dose to maintain protection against new virus variants. That means the U.S. government, which is picking up the bill for the current round of vaccinations and has provided billions of dollars to the public health departments, community health centers, hospitals, and pharmacies to get shots into arms, may have to keep those efforts running for months or even years. In addition, globally, a booster dose could further widen the gap between vaccinated and unvaccinated countries, as some experts estimate it will take a year or more for the world to complete even a first round of vaccinations. It will be a few more months yet before health authorities know whether an additional dose will be needed. Scientists are still comparing levels of virus-fighting antibodies generated by people who are getting an additional dose with levels in those who are not. They're also keeping a close eye on any protection the extra dose could provide against the fast-growing SARS-CoV-2 variants that contribute to its quicker spread. So far, early studies show people vaccinated with the initially recommended doses have strong protection from COVID-19 for at least 6 months and likely longer, and those studies also suggest the immunity is broad enough to protect against different variants of the virus. It is all about timing. We are currently locked in a sort of arms race with the virus, but if more people are protected by vaccines, the virus will have fewer chances to infect people and generate new variants. A booster dose could increase the levels of virus-fighting immune cells in the bodies of those vaccinated, possibly going a long way toward tipping the balance in our favor and getting the pandemic better under control. Returning now to the last issue we have received, August 2/August 9, and Time's favorite places in the world. And I'll review a few more of these for you. Many of us may not be visiting these places in person because of the pandemic, but we can get little thumbnail sketches and bird's eye views of them from Times reporting. Sicily, Italy, history by the seaside. Italy's largest island is urging visitors back with government-subsidized incentives, including free hotel stays and museum access. Vouchers are in limited supply, sold through authorized travel agencies. New seaside resorts add further allure to Sicily's plentiful sites, which include Greek temples, Byzantine mosaics, and one of Europe's most active volcanoes. The latest Rocco Forte property, Villa Igea, housed in a historic villa overlooking the Bay of Palermo, opened in June after a 2-year renovation and offers sea views from its patio and terraced gardens. Another Forte offering, the Verdura Resort on the other side of the island, just debuted new villas and will soon have a golf course. Also fresh on the scene is San Domenico Palace Taormina, now a Four Seasons hotel situated on a cliffside on the site of a 14th-century convent with an infinity pool and 3 restaurants for guests to choose from. That article was written by Brecky Fletcher. Now, Ljubljana, Slovenia. And I'm going to spell that in case I have not pronounced it nearly well enough. Ljubljana, Slovenia, a culinary capital, written by Tamara Hardingham Gill. The Slovenian capital's already acclaimed gastronomic scene got a huge boost with the 2020 unveiling of its first ever Michelin guide. 6 of its restaurants have been awarded a total of 7 Michelin stars. Among them, Chef Jorg Zupan's much lauded Atelje, A-T-E-L-J-E, which reopened in May after pivoting to takeout during the pandemic, returning to its ever-changing tasting menu, showcasing Slovenian ingredients like dry-aged kurskuja pork. Odprta Kuna, Open Kitchen, the Friday night food market featuring the area's top food purveyors, whose return has been highly anticipated, is also one of the city's most beloved culinary traditions. Other notable additions include Fuzzy Log, an eco-friendly hostel, whose guests can sleep in rooftop tents and log cabins, among other options, and soon Kukrarna, C-U-K-R-A-R-N-A, a repurposed 19th-century sugar refinery, which will debut next year as a new mixed-use cultural venue. Puerto Escondido, Mexico. Rising Design Destination, again by Brecky Fletcher. On the Pacific coast, a small surf town known for its mix of laid-back chic and untamed oceanfront is quickly transforming into a design hub. In May, Puerto Escondido attracted the attention of international curators and collectors with its inaugural Mexican Design Fair, a buzzy event showcasing the work of an array of creators, including designer Liliana Ovalle and architect Pablo Kobayashi. Recent openings in the area include 2 boutique beachfront properties, Casona Svorza, a hotel whose exterior is defined by a series of clustered brick arches, and Hotel Escondido, a minimalist enclave with 16 thatched roof bungalows. New restaurants and bars are also popping up, such as Espacio Cometa, an unfussy outdoor sand-floored cafe that serves contemporary breakfast specialties like avocado toast and acai bowls, as well as cocktails and dinner at night. Later this year, celebrated local chef Alejandro Ruiz will open Casa Huascaca del Mar, a new seaside outpost of his Wacoxa City restaurant focusing on locally caught seafood. Now here's that suspension bridge I noticed last week. Arruca, A-R-U-C-A, Portugal, bridging the gap, Tamara Hardingham Gill writes. With its white churches and tiled town square, Arruca, a Portuguese town an hour south of Porto, was already noted for its beauty. Now, thanks to the debut of 516 Arruca, the world's longest pedestrian suspension bridge, Arruca's receiving global attention for its engineering. Made from steel cables, the 1,693-foot-long structure is suspended 574 feet above the Paiva River, a popular spot for rafting, and it takes around 10 minutes to cross. The newly opened attraction can be found in Arruca Geopark, part of UNESCO's European Geoparks network, and known for its nature tourism and extreme sports activities. The park also boasts a steep and zigzagging 5.1-mile-long wooden walking path, Roman and medieval ruins, and the Monastery of Arruca, one of the country's largest granite buildings. Lijiang, China, that's L-I-J-I-A-N-G. This is by Charlie Campbell. A launch point for adventure. With its ancient cobbled lanes and overlapping waterways, the Lijiang Old Town in Yunnan Province, named a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 1997, has long been a popular escape destination for China's city dwellers. The smoky flavors of dishes from the country's Naxi, N-A-X-I, minority, are popular with visitors, as is the selection of craft beers and cocktails in the charming pub Stone the Crows. And several new luxury hotels work to highlight the region's natural beauty, among them Hila Vintage Hotel and Cloud Nature Experience Center, whose undulating walkable roof mimics the rolling hills behind it, and Hilton Lijiang, which has its own hanging garden. Lijiang is also the main access point for Tiger Leaping Gorge, a spectacular hiking trail tracing the Jinsha River, which just reopened after a half-year closure for renovations. Desaru Coast, Malaysia, D-E-S-A-R-U. A Beach Escape by Duncan Forgan. The saying, if you build it, they will come, is very true of Desaru Coast, an ambitious new resort area in the state of Johor. Spanning more than 3,900 acres along a pristine 17-kilometer stretch of beachfront real estate, the area offers some of Malaysia's most coveted luxury bolt holes. In 2020, the one and only Desaru Coast, the brand's first property in Asia, debuted as a spectacular tropical sanctuary with a spa and golf course. Also newly opened is the Anantara Desaru Coast Resort and villas with lush gardens and lagoon swimming pools. Other draws include championship golf courses and cruises through the Sedili Wetlands, a freshwater swamp home to the endangered water trumpet. The imminent open of the Desaru Coast Ferry Terminal will offer increased transit options for Singapore and Indonesia. Virgin Gorda, British Virgin Islands, Respite and Renewal by Sarah Greaves Gabadon. After being hit by Hurricanes Irma and Maria in 2017, the British Virgin Islands are on the mend, and nowhere in the territory's approximately 60 islands and cays is the recovery more noticeable than in the North Sound on the northern coast of Virgin Gorda, home to several iconic island resorts. The Gorda Corridor sees the return of classic retreats, including Rosewood Little Dick's Bay, a family-friendly resort that offers seclusion along a mile-long beach after a four-year closure and a multi-million-dollar renovation. Saba Rock, a small island and beloved watering hole for boaters that was previously closed because of hurricane damage, has been fully renovated and reopens in the fall as a 9-suite private resort. And neighboring, Bitter End Yacht Club, also in the midst of rebuilding, plans to unveil a clutch of bungalows and a restaurant and bar by year's end, signaling, one hopes, a sweet start to 2022. And finally, in this reading, Phu Quoc, Vietnam, that's P-H-U space Q-U-O-C, Vietnam, idyllic paradise, written by Dan Q. Dao. Known as the Jewel of Vietnam, this teardrop-shaped resort and fishing island has become one of the fastest-growing destinations in Southeast Asia. In 2019, Phu Quoc attracted 5 million visitors, a 30% increase from the year before. It is expected to reopen to vaccinated international travelers in the fall and continues to entice tourists with visa-free stays for up to 30 days. Lodging options abound. Earlier this year, the expansive 375-villa New World Phu Quoc Resort, which boasts a private stretch of beach and lush landscaped gardens, made its debut, as did the $2.8 billion Phu Quoc United Center, a massive entertainment complex featuring a theme park, golf course, and casino, in addition to a series of hotels. Nearby, the Regent Phu Quoc, a new ultra-luxury hotel with 5 swimming pools and floor-to-ceiling beach-facing windows, is expected to welcome its first guests by December. From another set of small articles entitled The Brief, News Ticker, Court Finds Masterpiece Cake Shop. Jack Phillips, the baker who won a First Amendment case before the U.S. Supreme Court in 2018 after refusing to design a gay couple's wedding cake, was fined $500 by a Colorado judge June 15 over his bakery's 2017 refusal to produce a cake celebrating a trans woman's identity. Leftist leads in divisive Peru election. Results from Peru's June 6 presidential election put far-left candidate Pedro Castillo ahead with 50.1% of the vote. His far-right opponent, Keiko Fujimori, has claimed voter fraud. Authorities are still finalizing the count, the U.S. said. June 22, the elections were free and fair. Medicaid hits record levels among COVID-19. Enrollment in Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, reached new highs during the coronavirus pandemic. As of January, more than 80 million people in the U.S. had coverage under the public health programs, with nearly 10 million signing up in the previous 12 months. A photo here in shades of brown. Brown floor, brown walls that look like either brick or concrete block. Brown things, spools of something, sitting on the floor with just a pathway for workers to walk. 3 brown men wearing brown clothes, carrying sacks across their shoulders. They look like heavy sacks. The caption reads, "Continued crisis. workers carry sacks of wheat to be distributed among those who fled ongoing violence, including reported human rights abuses and atrocities in Ethiopia's Tigray region, June 22, in Mekelle, the region's capital. Voting began June 21 in a parliamentary election critics say has been marred by delays, instability, and a boycott by some parties. Its results are expected to cement Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's hold on power amid what international observers have described as an authoritarian shift. And that caption was written by Madeline Roach. More news ticker. Hong Kong's Apple Daily shuts down. In a blow to press freedom in Hong Kong, the pro-democracy newspaper Apple Daily announced June 23 it would close its doors, following a campaign of legal harassment by authorities. In the past week, police have arrested staff and frozen bank accounts. Its activist founder, Jimmy Lai, L-A-I, is already serving prison sentences. GOP blocks Dem voting rights bill. Senate Republicans moved June 22 to block the For the People Act, a sweeping Democratic-backed voting rights bill that would further access to the ballot. Progressives ramped up their calls to abolish the legislative filibuster, the tool used by the GOP to block the bill, in response, arguing it's the only option left. Tense food shortage in North Korea. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un warned his country's facing a food shortage because of sanctions, recent flooding, and COVID-19, state media reported June 16. In a rare admission, Kim said it was essential for the whole party and state to concentrate on farming to keep food stocks up. A small inset here with some photos of the subjects. World. Royal dropouts. Megxit. Britain's Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle gave up their royal patronages when fully stepping back from official royal duties in 2021. Citing racism and hostility Markle experienced from the press and the palace itself. Lost title. Norway's Princess Martha Louise gave up her Royal Highness status in 2002 to work on her career, but continued using her princess title in commercial contexts. After backlash in 2019, she said she would stop. All for Love. In 2017, Japan's Princess Mako announced her engagement to her college boyfriend, Kei Komuro, a commoner. While the couple's not yet wed, Japanese law dictates that Mako must leave the imperial family once she is married. And the heir to the Dutch throne, 17-year-old Princess Amalia, requested June 11 that her nearly $2 million annual income be waived while she remains a student and cannot perform royal duties, saying the stipend makes her uncomfortable. And that article was written by Madeline Carlisle. Good question. What's the future for U.S. cities as segregation grows? The U.S. is an increasingly diverse nation, but this obscures a troubling trend. Its cities are more segregated now than they were 30 years ago. More than 80% of large metropolitan areas across the U.S. were more segregated in 2019 than in 1990, according to an analysis released June 21 by the Othering and Belonging Institute at the University of California, Berkeley. Detroit's the most segregated city, followed by Hialeah, Florida, then Newark, New Jersey, Chicago, and Milwaukee, the report says. Only two of 113 cities with populations of 200,000 or more qualified as integrated, Colorado Springs and Port St. Lucie, Florida. While the U.S. has become more diverse over time, this has obscured the persistence of segregation, the report finds. Metropolitan areas are not all white, all black, or all Latino, but within them, different races live in segregated neighborhoods, creating social and economic divisions. The conclusion may not be surprising in a country confronting racial disparities laid bare by COVID-19 and by the murder of George Floyd last year, but as many wealthy Americans get to work remotely and live where they like in the pandemic's aftermath, it calls into question whether the U.S. will become even more segregated and polarized as they flee cities for the suburbs. This country is still in dire shape, warned Stephen Menendian, assistant director at the Institute, which studies the roots of social and economic inequality in the U.S. The uprisings of the last few years are not going to die down as long as we have a deeply racially unjust and racially segregated society. The report shows that efforts to integrate housing have fallen short, including the Fair Housing Act of 1968, which sought to prohibit racial discrimination in the sale or rental of housing. Affluent communities responded with zoning laws that blocked the construction of multifamily or low-income residential units. Black Americans faced with redlining and other racist practices were kept out. You really cannot name any significant social injustice in the United States that is not undergirded by residential housing segregation, says Craig Gourian, executive director of the Anti-Discrimination Center, which litigates fair housing cases. Jurisdictions themselves know very well they're segregated, Gourian says. The absence of change is not for them an absence of information, it's an absence of will. There are few big policy ideas that could quickly reverse this segregation. Some cities, like Berkeley, California, have eradicated single-family zoning. In theory, this should allow construction of more residential units and lower prices, but Berkeley will have to build at an almost unimaginable scale to make housing affordable. A two-bedroom apartment there rents for almost $3,000, that's $3,000 a month, according to real estate site Zumper. And that article was written by Alana Samuels. Here are a couple of milestones to report confirmed. Zahid Qureshi as a U.S. District Court judge by the U.S. Senate June 10, making him the first Muslim American federal judge in U.S. history. Approved blood donation by gay and bisexual men in England, Scotland, and Wales. As of June 14, in a momentous shift in the UK's National Health Service guidelines. Died Richard Stolle, Man of the People, by Richard Stengel. Richard Stolle's People only seemed like a celebrity magazine. What really hooked its readers, Stolle, who launched the magazine in 1974, later explained, was its focus on extraordinary people doing ordinary things and ordinary people doing extraordinary things. Stolle, who died June 16 at age 92, had previously been one of Life magazine's most tenacious reporters. His work on the civil rights movement in the 1960s brought home to many Americans the bravery and idealism of racial justice protesters. And Stolle did not just report history, he made it. After John F. Kennedy's assassination, he flew to Dallas and single-handedly acquired the 26-second-long Zapruder film that documented JFK's death. It's now housed in the National Archives. Later, as an executive at Time, Inc., Time's former parent company, Stolle was unfailingly generous with young editors, myself included. Charming, wise, and self-deprecating, he was an extraordinary man who did extraordinary things. Returning to Time's 100 favorite places, Antarctica. A Rare Sight at the South Pole by Aaron Baker. In the early morning hours of December 4, 2021, a solar eclipse will plunge the Antarctic Peninsula into momentary darkness, offering the fortunate few who happen to be in the region not one but two rare experiences. Several Antarctic cruise lines are offering special expeditions set to coincide with the event, including Oceanwide Expeditions, Silver Sea, and Abercrombie and Kent, all of which will afford views from the iceberg-studded Weddell Sea, where the eclipse will be best seen in its totality. Demand for Antarctic cruises before the pandemic had increased over recent years, and most berths are already booked. But fear not, another Antarctic eclipse is on its way, December 15, 2039. And there's a photo here. It's stunning. Blue and white. An iceberg along the Antarctic Peninsula is sharp and jagged, sticking out of the sea, which doesn't look blue at all. It looks icy gray in color. And the background, which is surely faded by Photoshop, is a gray-brown. It's almost a dismal, dark, earthy color, and yet they are either mountains of snow and ice or more icebergs. Here's one more, a short one, Wadi Dana, Jordan, and that's spelled W-A-D-I space D-A-N-A, Jordan. Eyes in the Sky by Yula Denisyuk. Nestled in the remote Wadi Dana Valley, the Dana Biosphere Reserve is Jordan's largest nature preserve, spanning over 120 square miles of four distinct biogeographical zones. The reserve's home to rare regional flora and fauna, including 12 protected endangered animal species like the Syrian wolf and the spiny-tailed lizard. In March, to better protect the expansive area and animals that inhabit it, conservation experts launched drones to survey the region to help curb poaching and carry out surveys of the mountainous area. Wadi Dana is also at the forefront of ecotourism initiatives like the award-winning Fainan Eco Lodge, a solar-powered guest house that employs staff from local Bedouin families. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.